the Redskins. Hail victory! Praise on the warpath. Fight for all we see.
Green driven back to midfield on the far side. He's got the ball up to the 45, far side 40. A seam to the 35. Waltz a man to the 30. Breaks it to the near side 25. Watch out to the 20. Near side 10. He's gone. Touchdown, Washington Redskins.
This is Burgundy and Gold Flashback. Now, here's Mike Richmond.
You are listening to Burgundy and Gold Flashback, where the tradition of a storied NFL franchise, the Washington Redskins, stays alive. I'm Mike Richmond, author of the Redskins Encyclopedia and the Washington Redskins Football Vault. My website is redskinshistorian.com. That's redskinshistorian.com. My guest is one of the best cornerbacks to ever play for the Redskins. Played seven seasons in D.C., 1969 to 1975. Intercepted 30 passes, one of the top marks in Redskins history, with 478 return yards and three touchdowns. On the phone with me now from Gainesville, Florida, Mike Bass. Mike, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your giving me this opportunity to share some experiences with you.
Well, that's what we're all about, keeping the tradition alive, and great to have you on. You've been a tremendous help in the past with previous interviews for my books, so I really appreciate it. Thanks again. So how are you doing living down there in Gainesville? I understand you're retired now.
Yeah, I'm fine here in Gainesville. My health is pretty much okay. For anyone who's close to 70 years old, we're moving a little bit slower, but still, I'm thankful, quite frankly, that I have no real complaints. I typically have the aches and pains that any 70-year-old man would have, especially having spent so many years playing professional football. But all in all, I'm fine. My health, I don't have any real health issues. Quite frankly, and I'm glad to be alive.
And you are attending various Redskins alumni events. I remember seeing you at least at last year's Redskins alumni gathering. Were you there for this year's as well?
No. My wife and I didn't attend this last gathering. We had some previous commitments, but we would have loved to have been there for this last gathering. It's always great to share old stories and see who can tell the biggest lies when we all get together.
Well, things become a little embellished, I guess, as the years go on. So.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We had some great times. We had great teams. I think, were the epitome of what team really means. There is no I in team, and this was first really emphasized with Coach Lombardi when he came to Washington and followed up with George Allen. Nothing is more important than the team.
That era that you, when you played in Washington for George Allen, 1971 through 1975, the Redskins went to the playoffs four times during that period, including an appearance in Super Bowl VII. I'm wondering, what was it like playing for the Redskins during that period, in addition to that everyone was in it for the team? What was it like being a Redskin at that time?
It was just a fantastic experience. I think we may have been bigger than the president. And it was because of our team approach to everything that we brought the entire city together. And, of course, this, again, I can't emphasize enough, this was started with Coach Lombardi. And all we really needed really were the right coaches and a change in attitude from a losing attitude to one of how much are we going to win by. And, of course, the emphasis on the defense by Coach Allen was great as far as we on the defensive side of the ball was concerned.
Now, of course, before Lombardi came to Washington in 1969. The Redskins hadn't had a winning season since 1955. So you know, he put his winning touch on the squad in 69. That was a 7-5-2 year. And then when he passed away after the season, and then interim coach Bill Austin was there, and then Allen came in 1971. So you had the privilege of playing for two Hall of Fame coaches, two of the greatest in NFL history. I do want to get into that a little later. In terms of the fan atmosphere here in Washington, how crazy was it? You said that you brought the whole city together.
Oh, it was just maddening, and the fans gave us so much confidence. They supported us at every turn, and it was great to be recognized when we went out, when we were off the field. It was just a fantastic attitude, and it really encouraged us as players, particularly to not let each other down, and of course not to let the fans down as well. They were on our side, and I don't think that there were any better fans in the NFL than the fans we had in Washington at that time.
And like you say, it was a matter of you guys not just wanting to win, but you expected to win.
We expected to win, and you might call it pressure, but not really. Our fans expected us to win, and when we lost, we know that they hurt as bad as we did, and so it was a genuine and collective attitude of everyone in Washington, fans and players alike.
Now, I know a lot of Redskins fans were hurting after the Redskins lost in Super Bowl VII to the Dolphins 14-7, and the Dolphins, of course, finished that season 17-0, only undefeated team in NFL history. There's one sequence in that game, though, that I would like you to expound on, and it's one of the most bizarre plays in Super Bowl history. I'm sure many, many of our listeners can envision it. Your 49-yard return of a bobbled ball by Dolphins kicker Gail Yepremian. Could you just take us through that play?
Well, certainly. People don't realize this, but Gail and I are great, great friends. As a matter of fact, before coming to Washington, I was with the Detroit Lions, as was Gail. And we left Detroit at the same time. I came to Washington, and he went to the Dolphins. So we've had a long history together. But this play was indicative of the amount of attention that was paid by George Allen, and in particular, Marv Levy, who was then the special teams coach at that time, to special teams. You win games with all parts working together, offense, defense, and special teams. And my responsibility was one of, I guess I was called the spy man. On the other side, opposite me, Teddy Vactor was really the key person in trying to block kicks. And in the event that a kick was blocked, it was my responsibility to see what I could do to pick up that ball and return it for a touchdown. As a matter of fact, during my career, I think I returned a couple of those thanks to blocks by Teddy Vactor.
He was prolific as a kick blocker.
Oh, absolutely. He had a knack, and it does take a knack. But a lot of this, again, is paying attention to detail. When you hear two thumps, that's when you really look alive, because the first thump is when the ball is blocked, and the first thump is when the kicker kicks the ball. Second thump is when the ball is blocked. And as a spy man, I happened to be at the right place at the right time, and was fortunate enough to pick up the ball, catch the ball, when Gerald tried to toss it. It was declared a fumble. And my biggest fear, quite frankly, was don't let the kicker catch me. I never lived that down, especially with a team full of older guys, veterans who'd been around a lot of years. I would never have heard the end of that. But I was lucky. I got the ball. Gerald did try to tackle me, as did Earl Morrill, who was a holder at that time. And with that run, we were back in the ball game. Unfortunately, of course, we didn't win, and nobody really remembers the second place team. But all of that was really because our coaches paid attention to the little details.
And special teams, that was huge with George Allen.
That's right. That's exactly right.
After the kick, well, in terms of the kick being blocked, this is what Bill Brundage told me. He said he thinks that ball hit the helmet of the Dolphins center, a guy named Bob Hines.
Mm-hmm.
He does not think the kick was blocked because everybody was saying it was blocked by Brundage. And actually, what Ted Vactor told me is that he did get his hand a little bit on that ball. I guess you could say it was blocked in that sense. He told me he got his hand a little bit on the ball right after it was kicked, you know, as he was flying past.
I don't think it makes too much of a difference who hit it. Who actually blocked it? The fact is that we were able to score and we were back in the ball game,
right.
And that's a credit to the attention paid to special teams by our coaches.
Right. Now, in a previous interview, you told me that was not the most memorable play in your career, though.
Well, I've had several, quite frankly, but there were Monday night games that in which we beat Dallas. I've had a couple of interceptions returned for touchdowns. It's kind of a blur to me now. And oddly enough, my wife wakes me up at night on a number of occasions because I'm scoring touchdowns left and right in my dreams.
Well, I have you for scoring three touchdowns in regular season play, not including the Super Bowl play we just spoke about, but two interception returns, so one in 1971 and one in 1974, and then a fumble return in a 1972 win over the St. Louis Cardinals. So now you'll your dreams will be a little more clear when you
right.
I want to ask you about today's system with all of the leniency that receivers are given. They can't be touched within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage. It just seems that defensive backs, cornerbacks, safeties, whatever, you just can't breathe on a receiver. I mean, do you, when seeing this today, do you ever roll your eyes around and say, hey, you know, this is so vastly different from the system that I played in?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Not being the penalties that are called, particularly for interference. This lets me know that there are referees who have never put on a jock strap. And as a result, they don't really know what's going on. And a lot of times they see it after the fact. But you have to remember that these receivers know where they're going, and consequently the defensive backs have to react. And so defensive backs, and in particular the cornerbacks, are really the best athletes on the team. It's just too bad that their hands are tied as they are. But football, the NFL football, is the most popular game in the United States, and it's scoring that puts people in the stands, and that's the way it is now. And so as the years have gone by, all of us, particularly on the defense, have had to adapt.
Right. Well, all this has been very interesting. Right now, though, we need to go to break. When we come back, I want to talk to you more about your career. Here's This Week in Redskins History.
Hey, it's Mike Richmond, the official Redskins historian and author of the Washington Redskins Football Vault and the Redskins Encyclopedia. from the pages of my books comes this week in Redskins history. 73-0. Yep, that's the knockout blow the Bears delivered to the Redskins in the NFL Championship game at DC's Griffith Stadium on December 8, 1940. It stands as the widest single-game margin in NFL history. Chicago was unmerciful, pounding the Skins with a display of firepower that leaves football historians and trivia buffs in awe. The Bears scored 11 touchdowns and steamrolled the Redskins' D with a ground attack that tallied 372 yards and scored on runs of 68, 44, 42, and 23 yards. On defense, Chicago intercepted 8 passes and returned 3 for TDs. New York Times sports writer Arthur J. Daly summed up the domination this way: "The weather was perfect. So were the Bears." For more on Redskins history, check out my website at redskinshistorian.com. That's redskinshistorian.com. I'm Mike Richmond for This Week in Redskins History.
Welcome back to Burgundy and Gold Flashback. I'm Redskins historian Mike Richmond, back with former Redskins cornerback Mike Bass, a member of the Redskins' 80 Greatest Team. Mike, thanks again for coming on the show.
Again, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, great to have you on. Well, you played your college ball at Michigan, and you were drafted by the Green Bay Packers in 1967, and there's a really, really interesting story I want you to share with us regarding Vince Lombardi. I know you were released on the final day of training camp in 67. So tell us, what did Lombardi say to you at that time when you were released?
Well, one of the great things that you respect about Coach Lombardi was that he didn't let anyone else do what he thought was his job. And every person who played for the Packers and were cut, he would speak to them directly. He wouldn't send anybody there to do his job. And I was cut on the last cut, and oddly enough, one of my teammates from Michigan, John Rouser, was the one that they kept over me. But in walking in to see Coach Lombardi, he looked me dead in the eye, and he always called me Michael. And he said, "Michael, you can play in this league." And that was enough for me to try to hook on somewhere else and get another opportunity. And I was fortunate enough to be picked up by the Detroit Lions, but I languished on their taxi squad, their reserve squad, really for 2 years. And it was fortunate for me that when Coach Lombardi came out of retirement, he contacted me and asked me to come to Washington. And I jumped at the chance to come back and play for him. And during the training camp of 1969, I think it was the first or second practice, he put me in the starting lineup. And I ended up starting every game, I think 104 or 110 games straight. All with Coach Lombardi, and then that season that was disastrous with Bill Austin, and then with the 8 years with George Allen. I didn't finish that eighth year. I had gotten hurt the year before in making a tackle against the Giants. It really kind of ended my career, although I did finish the season that year.
You had a neck injury, right?
Yes, I had a neck injury, and really, in going to training camp, I was a little concerned. And when I got hit in training camp in a scrimmage of some sort, I had to face facts. I'd been playing for 10 years in the league, almost 10 years, and I was bucking the odds. And I really didn't want to risk further injury, particularly when you have a neck injury. I didn't want to risk further injury that still it bothers me now.
Regarding the 69 season with Lombardi there, and it sounds like you were thrilled to be reunited with him. The Redskins, as I mentioned earlier, they went 7-5-2 that year, first winning season since 1955. But Lombardi passed away right before the 1970 season from cancer. Tell me, how devastating was his death to you and the rest of the team?
It was really devastating. We came to love that man not only as a coach, but a human being, a coach who was fair, a coach who looked after his players, a coach who did not let you wonder where he stood on anything. He drove us hard, but he never drove us beyond the point that he thought would be detrimental to us. He created that atmosphere of believing in ourselves. You could see from Sonny Jurgensen down to the guys on the Cav squad that we were forming something that was different. And thanks to the support that we got from the fans, all of this brought us closer together.
And that that winning attitude had to have carried over when George Allen came here in 1971. I know you had that disastrous season under Austin in 1970, but many of those same players were still around in 71. You just needed another leader. And it must have been a dream come true for you that Allen came here because he was a defensive specialist.
Oh, absolutely. And not only a specialist, but a genius in terms of defensive football. And it felt like we were on the attack. We were not reacting. We were making other teams react to what we did. And you can't lose a game if the other team doesn't score. And it is an emphasis was placed on scoring on defense. And we had some great defensive leaders in Jack Pardee and particularly Chris Hamburger. And I played with some of the greatest players that have ever played. Brig Owens, Pat Fisher, Kenny Houston. These were just dynamic players. And of course, there's always Harold McClinton, who is just coming into his own as well. And we played and we gelled as a team. And as you get, as you gain more and more experience, the game slows down for you, and so you're able to recognize and react to certain things before the ball was snapped, even while after the ball was snapped. And it comes with experience and as a defensive back, knowing where your help is coming from. But more than that, spending time looking at film, trying to pick up tips that will give you that edge. And as you become more experienced, that film work allows you to see things that most young players, rookies, just don't see. And that's what made us great. And then it didn't hurt us to have real competitors on the offensive side like Billy Kilmer, Sonny Jurgensen, Charlie Taylor, and Roy Jefferson, who I thought was one of the best wide receivers in all of football.
He's part of the 80 greatest as well. And actually, he was my guest last week. Just a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Oh, absolutely. And I had to go up against these guys every day in practice. He, Charlie Taylor, Frank Grant, these were guys that were different. And they were so good. I respected them so much. And all of them made me a better football player.
Tell me about your relationship with George Allen. It seems like he... Or did he not consider you one of his lieutenants, like Brig Owens and those guys?
Well, not so much that. When you're a defensive cornerback in the schemes that we played, George Allen knew enough to leave Pat and I alone. We had enough on our hands covering the likes of Paul Warfield or Mel Gray or some of these receivers who are in the Hall of Fame, and others like Harold Carmichael. We had enough on our plate. We didn't need, and our concentration was such that we needed to concentrate on those things at hand. I didn't want to be a lieutenant, quite frankly, and neither did Pat. Leave us alone. Let us do our job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the greatness of great coaches. They don't interfere unless it's absolutely necessary. And had we not been doing our job, we wouldn't have been there in the first place.
Did George Allen command respect the same way that Vince Lombardi did? I know that Lombardi had this militaristic style and Allen's was completely different, but did he command respect the same way?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They were different types of coaches, and you're right. Coach Lombardi was very militaristic. George Allen said, and he practiced this, give me the old guys who know what they're doing so I don't have to tell them much. Let me just get them ready for the game with tendencies and so forth. Because there's no way he's going to tell me how to cover Paul Warfield or one of these great receivers. And so he let us do our thing within the scope of the defense. And it was up to us to know where our help was. And I relied heavily on Chris Hamburger, on Brig Owens, on Kenny Houston. Quite frankly, because they helped me become a better football player. But both coaches were dynamic in every respect, but they were different, quite different from each other. And I appreciated that. You'd run through a wall for Coach Lombardi just to get him to say, good job, Mike. At the same time, you appreciated the respect that George Allen gave you as a pro. And so they were two different types of coaches, but, of course, very, very much respected. And they were a part of us, and we were a part of them.
Now, you mentioned Kenny Houston and Pat Fisher as well, and I know you've told me that both of them helped you become a better hitter.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on that?
Well, particularly as a defensive back, your primary job is to stop people from catching passes. Consequently, you don't really have all those many opportunities to hit. But I learned from Pat in particular and Kenny the proper approach to hitting, which is not necessarily to make that big hit, but to stop that running back in particular from gaining any more yards. And so, really, there's a science to it, and Pat really had it down. You know, he was 5'7", 170 pounds, and yet he could take on these running backs who really didn't want to have anything to do with him. And it taught me a lot. I still wasn't the greatest hitter. I could hold my own. My forte was in covering. But at the same time, as a complete defensive back, you've got to do both. And so as the years went by, I learned to be better at it and began to pride myself in stopping running backs in particular from gaining any more yardage, and to do so without getting hurt myself.
Well, this has been fascinating, Mike, and just want to thank you again for coming on Burgundy and Gold Flashback and for all the time you've given me for previous interviews, and I hope we cross paths at upcoming Redskins alumni events.
Well, looking forward to it. If we get other invitations from the Redskins, and particularly Bruce, then certainly I look forward to these reunions on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure those invitations will come your way.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, and many thanks to my audience for listening to Burgundy and Gold Flashback. Thanks to my producer, Mike Engel, for his work running the board. I'm Mike Richman. My website is redskinshistorian.com. That's redskinshistorian.com. For now, Hail to the Redskins!